girls. What? Keep it fresh.
Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In 2009, armed with a camera and research, Carol Ott began outing Baltimore's slumlords. On her blog, Baltimore Slumlord Watch, she shared information about the owners of vacant and neglected properties, who she saw as contributing to the decay of Baltimore neighborhoods. The project found a wide audience, and Carol's next step was a nonprofit called Housing Policy Watch, which works to create a more equitable city through affordable and safe housing. When I spoke to Carol last week, we talked about Baltimore's vacants and the intersection of housing and public health, among other things. Here's our conversation. So you're the director of Housing Policy Watch, which kind of got its start as the Baltimore Slumlord Watch Project. I was hoping you could kind of take me back to where this all began for you.
Well, it all began after I was laid off from a job and didn't really have anything to do. And I noticed that Baltimore had a lot of vacant properties, particularly in my neighborhood where I lived at the time. And I started taking photos of them, and then I started researching them, finding out who owned them, and it became really clear to me that Baltimore had a lot of negligent property owners. So I thought, well, why not just post all of this information on the internet so that neighbors could have access to it easily and maybe contact them or contact their city council person. And, you know, maybe some of these properties could get rehabbed or taken away from the negligent owners and given to people who would at least take care of them, if not completely fix them up. So that was the idea for the Baltimore Slumlord Watch. And I had no idea that anybody would ever read that blog or care about it. It was just something I did because I needed something to do. And I started getting emails from people across town in other cities, you know, saying, well, can you help me with this property? Or could you find out who owns this other property? Could you help? Could you help? Could you help? And so it just sort of snowballed into this big thing. And it ended up being much bigger than I ever anticipated, certainly. And after doing that for X number of years, I think it was like 8, maybe 7. But I decided that if I wasn't going to start focusing then on solutions and also looking at the policies and the laws and the people who sort of allowed this long-term decline to happen with, you know, as far as I could see, no accountability, no checks, no balances. If I wasn't going to focus on those things, then I needed to just stop altogether. And because I had so much momentum from the first project, from the Slumlord Watch project, I decided to then sort of focus and channel my efforts into reshaping the conversation around policy, particularly as it applies to housing in Baltimore City. So that's how the Housing Policy Watch sort of started.
Before starting the Slumlord Watch project, did you have experience in housing? Did you have a previous interest in, you know, in vacants or in the housing of communities you lived in? Or was this kind of like a totally eye-opening new thing for you?
I had worked previously for an architecture firm in D.C. for about 10 years. I edited building specifications, and I had a real interest in building materials, and I also had an interest in communities and neighborhoods and what happens to communities and neighborhoods once the housing stock goes away or changes or, you know, so the interest was there. And then also my parents back in the early 70s, we had our house custom built. So we went from an apartment to a big house. I mean, it wasn't huge, not a mansion, but, you know, it was a really nice house. And so while my dad was at work, my mom would go to the construction site and check up on things, and she would take me. And so even to this day, 40 many years later, I still have very strong memories when I smell sawdust and, you know, lumber right from the lumber yard and mortar and all of these things. So it's always been there. I just didn't realize it or didn't have a way to sort of channel it until I started doing this work. And then also both of my parents are photographers. My dad actually won a bunch of awards back in the day. And so photography has always been a really important thing to me. I never got serious about it until after my father died in 2005. So then I picked that up, and then so it just all sort of started to mesh into this one amorphous thing that, you know, I still, even now, after I've been doing this work for almost 10 years, and I still don't know where it's going, but I know what I would like to see happen, if that makes any sense.
It probably seems kind of obvious, but with the photography component, I feel like it just really drives home probably what a lot of people don't see in their everyday, right? Like, do you think that before you started paying attention, you were aware of all of these vacants? Do you think a lot of people in the wealthier parts of Baltimore are aware? What was your sense of that?
No, I don't think a lot of people are aware. And I think part of the reason for that is that Baltimore, unlike D.C., where I moved from in 2000, Baltimore is a very car-centric culture and city. You pretty much have to own a car in order to be able to get around in the city, which is, you know, really unfortunate, because when you drive, you miss so much. And a lot of what you miss is, it may look ugly from the get-go. I mean, nobody's going to say, hey, vacants are beautiful. Actually, I do. But, you know, most normal people would not say that. But there's a lot of dignity to them. I mean, these, you know, our housing stock in Baltimore is old. So when you look at a vacant, you know, in Harlem Park, let's say, you know, that house was built probably in the mid 1800s. It's still standing. It may have lost its roof. It may have lost, you know, a wall or two. The floors may be gone, but the structure and the dignity of that house is still there. And so sort of capturing that quiet dignity that these homes still have, I think, is really important. And also, you have to think about what goes on in people's homes. You celebrate the best moments of your life. You bring home your new bride. You bring home your child when, you know, after you have your wife has a baby, or, you know, so you have these wonderful moments, but then you also have the worst moments. You know, during World War II, you had mothers who got that horrible knock at the door to say that their son or daughter had been killed overseas. You have now mothers who sit at home in their house just waiting for that knock. And unfortunately, nowadays, it's more likely to be the police department coming to tell you that your son or daughter has been murdered on a street corner. So those stories and those moments, I think, deserve more than what they're getting.
I guess, like, why do vacants matter? Why does, beyond the emotional connection that you just described, if someone's neighborhood has a lot of vacants, or there's an entire vacant block, which we do have in Baltimore, why is that a problem, essentially? And what should be done about that?
When you see a lot of vacants, typically the first reaction that people have is, oh, that's terrible. And a lot of times they don't even know why it's terrible. It's just the first thing that sort of pops into your psyche. And then once you start looking into why these houses are vacant, you know, you had white flight and you had all of these real estate scams, even as recently as, you know, 2005. So they symbolize the worst of humanity. They symbolize the cruelty and the bad things that we do to each other as human beings. We swindle each other. We murder each other. We run away when things get bad. And we leave our neighbors behind to clean up the mess and deal with the crime and deal with the joblessness and all of the other things. So nobody wants to live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of vacants. And I totally get that. I mean, I'm kind of an outlier when it comes to my love of the vacants. I get it. But what we need to do is we need to start looking at why these things happened. Because if we don't acknowledge how this came to be, we're never going to be able to stop it from happening again. And we're never going to be able to stop what's going on now. I mean, right now, Baltimore is in a population decline.
I wanted to ask about how, I mean, it's a big question, but how Baltimore and Baltimore housing to you is different now than when you started this project.
I think it's not that different, to be honest. I mean, we've demolished a bunch of vacants, which, okay, we've demolished a lot of unsafe structures. That's a good thing. Nobody will walk by or sit next to one in their car and have it topple over on them, which actually happened and the poor man died. So I'm happy that we're demolishing a lot of the unsafe ones. What I would like to see, however, is I would like there to be more of a policy focus, and I would like for people to look at why this happened. Why did we end up with 30,000 vacant structures in our city? And what can we do to ensure that something like that could never happen again? And why is it that we're allowing certain neighborhoods to be like they're still full of vacants, but yet other neighborhoods are being revitalized or gentrified or whatever. They're being redone, made over, everything's okay. But yet we're still allowing certain neighborhoods to plummet. And, you know, we have to look at why we're doing that and stop doing that.
I've seen you talk about how Baltimore is often framed as going through a renaissance. And yeah, so there's an eye roll for people who
yes,
can't see.
Yes, I did. I rolled my eyes.
Explain the eye roll. I would like to hear your thoughts on this quote unquote Baltimore renaissance.
I think for some people, yes, Baltimore. And I don't like the use of the word renaissance. It bothers me because there actually was a period in time that was and is referred to as the Renaissance, and it was about from, you know, the 14th century to early mid 17th century. So I don't really.
So that's over and done.
Yeah, we've moved on, but some people are experiencing a better Baltimore. They're experiencing, you know, new shiny housing developments, and they're experiencing corporate welfare. I mean, oops, tax incentives. And they're experiencing more shopping, and they're experiencing better schools and better everything. But until that is happening citywide, that's not a real, and I'm not, darn, I hate that word, renaissance. But it unless it affects everybody in a positive way, it's not a sustainable long-term change. It's just a nice blip in history.
That's kind of the tension between gentrification and a true revitalization, isn't it?
Absolutely. Gentrification isn't for everyone. It's not done for everyone. And it's not a long-term goal. A true revitalization affects every person in every quadrant of the city in a positive way. We're not doing that. We're allowing some neighborhoods to continue to decline. The crime rate is skyrocketing. Look where most of the crime is happening. You know, I tell people all the time, if you take a red line map from the 1940s and then you overlay the current day vacant map, you overlay the tax sale map, you overlay the lead paint violation map, the crime map, any and all maps of bad things, you overlay them with the red line map, and you'll see that they almost very neatly line up. So you're just looking then at these two dark patches on either side, east and west, of our city. And until those two dark patches are no longer dark with dots indicating that bad things are going on here, then you haven't revitalized anything.
What initially brought you to Baltimore?
Well, interestingly, so my son's father is a musician, and he needed to be near multiple airports at all times to be able to fly overseas or fly across the country or whatever. And so Baltimore was a good central location. We were only going to stay here for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years and then move probably to New York. Well, 17 years later, here I am. He's gone, but I'm still
but
here.
But you're still here. I mean, did you love Baltimore from the get-go? What has kept you here?
No, I didn't. In fact, maybe, I don't know, 3 weeks after we moved here, I forget what happened, but there was a big scene not far from our house with the police and somebody had been shot or something. And so I just remember, you know, having this sort of, you know, temper tantrum, but not public. Luckily, it was all in my head, you know, sort of screaming at myself, we're leaving. We're not going to stay here. And it was just, but then I thought, well, okay, but crime happens everywhere. So, you know, what are you going to do? You're really going to pack up and you've only been here 3 weeks and you've got a newborn. So yeah, we just ended up staying. And then one of the reasons why, you know, I've stayed as long as I have is I have made some amazing friends here, and I have this fantastic network and support system. And, you know, this is also the only city. I mean, this is where my son has grown up, literally from the time he, you know, we brought him home from the hospital. So, you know, for him, I want him to have that continuity of, you know, a continuity of place. And I think that's important for kids.
Did you have that when you were a kid?
I did. And so it, you know, I think despite being, you know, when you're a kid, you hate every moment of, you know, you hate your parents and you hate school and you hate, you know, you just hate everything, which is what my son is going through now. He's 17. But as an adult now, I appreciate that being able to have the same friends now that I knew when I was 9. I mean, you're talking about a really long time. So, and being able to have those memories.
You see that a lot in Baltimore, too. So many of the people I've interviewed are born and raised here, as they say, and it's very generational. And I think there's a lot of, as you say, continuity of place in Baltimore. There's mm-hmm. something that really keeps people here.
Yeah, I honestly, some people are still here because they're stuck here. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at some of our neighborhoods, and not to be a Debbie Downer, which I get accused of that all the time, but if you and your husband in 1968 bought a house in certain Baltimore neighborhoods, you know, you were a school teacher, maybe your husband worked for the Postal Service, this was your first home, and you paid $8,000. For your home. And that was a good chunk of change back in, you know, the late 60s, whenever. So you paid $8,000 for your house. And now that it's 2017, your husband's long gone. He died 20 years ago. You're still here. Your house isn't worth much more than what you paid for it in 1968. So, you know, that's part of the reason why a lot of people are still here. But then there is the overarching reason that a continuity of place is extremely important. And, you know, last night I happened to be at Morgan State University talking with Dr. Lawrence Brown and Dr. Wooten. This was Dr. Brown's class. And somebody was saying, you know, about why don't people leave? And, you know, you're talking about, you know, you've got grandma around the corner, you've got an aunt next door, you've got this support network. And you've got these people that are sort of your safety net for when things go wrong. Who would walk away from that? You kind of can't, you know. So I think there's a lot of reasons why people stay.
Going off the name of your initial project, what kind of characteristics do slumlords have?
They're negligent property owners. They don't, whether they have a tenant in the property or not. They are people who don't make repairs to their property, don't do maintenance to their property. They don't care what happens to the tenant or to the neighbors that live around the property. They're just negligent. They're resource vultures. They collect their rent check and they take their money back to the suburbs or even to another state, and they don't contribute anything to the well-being of a community or to a family or to a city. They just take.
What do you think is the responsibility of landlords of the vacants, for example? What do they owe to their community, if anything?
You need to make sure that those properties are secured so that people can't get into them. You need to make sure that if your house is, you know, in Baltimore, we have so many row homes. So it's just basically one large structure in some ways, you know, with dividing walls in between each segment. So if the house next door to me is vacant and there's a hole in the roof and it's leaking, chances are that's going to affect my house. And so when you don't take care of your property and you don't maintain your roof and you don't fix your roof, now you're causing mold and you're causing all sorts of issues for the person who does live next door. And so that's not okay.
You have obviously helped a lot of people who turned to you for guidance when you were doing this project and still now. I mean, what kinds of stories and complaints did you hear from them? What is it about, I guess, this system that makes it very difficult for people to get answers and get help?
The number one thing that I hear from people, and it's really heartbreaking. So they'll call on the phone or send an email, and there's this really long story, whatever the story may be. It could be that the house next door is causing, you know, mold and rats to come into somebody else's house, or it could be I'm living in a house, you know, my landlord won't fix the furnace, so it's, you know, 30 degrees outside and I don't have heat. Or, you know, there was a lady who she had no stove. So, but the number one thing that either ends the story or it's the very first thing that they say is, I can't get anyone to listen to me. And that's the part for me, it's like the knife twisting. I mean, the story is usually bad enough, but that part of it is what twists the knife. Nobody will listen to me.
Going from the Slumlord Watch blog to Housing Policy Watch, tell me about what the organization does.
A lot of research, some mapping, some data sharing, some still the same with, you know, people calling and emailing saying, you know, nobody will listen, nobody will help. The one that I hate is you're my last hope, because I think to myself, oh, buddy, you know, if I'm your last hope, we're both at, yeah, boy, mm-hmm. We're out of luck.
And that's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. But so it's kind of the same, only it's more focused on the why and then how to fix all of this. And it's about building relationships with the people that I need to build relationships with in order to get this fixed.
What kinds of long-term, bigger picture things do you work toward? Because I know that with the blog and everything, it was successful in, you know, outing specific slumlords, essentially humiliating them, and then it caused a positive action and they would do something about it a lot of the time, or some of the time at least. So some of the time. So how do you change, you know, policy on the bigger level rather than just coming up against like slumlord after slumlord and trying to specifically address that?
I honestly don't know. And that's kind of the part that keeps me going, is that I don't think there is one answer, and I don't think that any answer that I could give or anybody could give is the correct answer. So I think what you have to do, sort of as an advocate, you have to be almost very singular in your focus. And mine has always been focused around housing in some way. And so right now, the focus has been more on, you know, racism and how racism affects public policy. And when you talk about housing, you can't really talk about housing without talking about racism. So tying the two together and ending the racism aspect of housing is obviously a very lofty and probably admittedly unattainable goal. But if I can just get enough people to stop making things like white privilege, for example, it's not about you. It's about the fact that you are able to do things and affect change in ways that other people cannot. So you need to take that privilege and you need to use that privilege to make sure that your life is not having a negative impact on other people in the city. And you need to make sure that if you are an advocate and you're earning six figures and you're living in a upper class white, upper income white neighborhood, that you're also talking to your neighbors about these things and you're getting your neighbors on board with things like affordable housing and inclusionary housing and enforcing the fair housing laws that we have. So, you know, these are it's all about, still for me, it's very much about changing the conversation.
Do you think that happens much? I mean, not to be a pessimist, but I do feel like, you know, so many people still think racism is just personal interactions and might not connect it with something like housing. I mean, how do you see maybe like wealthy white people in Baltimore addressing or not addressing these issues?
Well, considering we're sitting in the Baltimore Sun building, have you read the comments section on most Baltimore Sun articles?
I happen to be someone who is tasked with reading those comments.
So you know.
Yeah.
You know that people still don't get it. But so that sort of leaves you, as an advocate, it leaves you with two options. When you realize that people still aren't getting it and people still aren't doing what they're supposed to do in order to change it, you either quit and throw your hands up and say, well, okay, at least I tried. And then you move on and, I don't know, go do something else. Or you just keep pushing forward in the hopes that if I could just pick up one person and then that person picks up one more person. And I'll give you a really good example. I tweeted about it this morning. You know, I know a lot of people in this city, and a good number of them are advocates for whatever, not just housing. And a lot of them are women. So when I first started all of this, and then maybe, you know, halfway through, so like 5 years later, I'm following all of these people on Twitter and I'm listening to them or reading their words, but they're saying things like, you know, we have to be nice. You know, it's the carrot, not the stick. And, you know, this has to be a safe space for everybody to, you know, voice their opinion. So we went from this group of women, which frustrated me, of course, to no end. But now half of them, I see them on Twitter and I hear them in person completely losing it over this stuff now. Like, they've totally done a shift to the happy, let's all hold hands and sing songs kind of advocacy to, no, you're a racist and we're going to make sure that you do not thrive in our city as a racist. And, you know, so there's been a shift and there continues to be a shift. And so it's watching these folks sort of, you know, do a sea change on how they do their advocacy. It keeps me going. Because you think, okay, it's not just me anymore, or it's not just me plus five other people. Now there's a bunch of us.
That does seem like a trend in advocacy on the whole. It reminds me of, you know, feminism going from, oh, like, you know, any claim of feminism, man, problematic, whatever it may be, we should embrace. Versus now you have a lot more outspoken people being like, no, this is wrong. You know, we got to fix this. even within the Democratic Party, I kind of think of like the Hillary Democratic Party versus the leftists who are like, no, we can't go.
No.
But anyways, that's a tangent. I just feel like I'm really seeing that in a lot of different types of groups.
Yes.
Being fed up with being moderate and inclusive of all the opinions and any way of getting things done.
No, there are some opinions, honestly, that I won't entertain. I just read an article this morning, as a matter of fact, in the Washington Post. Sorry, but you know.
How dare you speak those words?
I know, sorry. But it was about some guy, and I don't remember his name because I was kind of like, I honed in on the pull quote, you know, that they had. But this guy, he worked for Homeland Security and he worked somewhere else. But he actually said out loud to other people that the reason why cities are the way they are is because Black people are lazy and stupid. And I'm thinking to myself, no, this guy doesn't get a voice in my world. No. And people like him. No, you don't get a voice in my world. Sorry, you shouldn't have a voice in anybody's world. So while I am a huge proponent of the First Amendment, I think what people need to realize is that the First Amendment, while it's a wonderful thing, and yes, it does give you all this freedom of speech, with that freedom comes consequences for the things you say. And I, of all people, know what those consequences can be sometimes, because I tend to not have much of a filter. But it also means that we, as a public, don't have to give you a free platform. I don't have to listen to you. Just like the people listening to this podcast, at some point, maybe they're just going to turn it off and not listen to me. That's fine, because that's what the First Amendment is. It isn't just that you get to say whatever you want. It's also that we don't have to listen to you.
Yeah, you get to speak back. I mean, I think a lot of people, it frustrates me too, just think that I get to say what I want to say, but then if you criticize me, that's not also you exercising your freedom of speech.
Exactly.
Or they forget that it's just really that the government can't prosecute you for your speech. It doesn't mean you have unlimited Reddit access.
Well, and that's the other thing. It's really, it was created so that citizens could speak out against the government without, you know, having to fear being locked up or, you know, worse, considering when the Constitution was written. But, you know, it doesn't mean that you get a free pass to say racist things. It just doesn't. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you get to be a racist. Sorry.
Well, and especially a quote like that. I mean, in Baltimore, and you brought up the redlining, but Baltimore, more than many cities in the U.S., has experienced extreme housing policies, redlining. I think you're a fan of Not in My Neighborhood, right?
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, it's a great book and would recommend it to anyone who's interested in housing. But maybe for people who don't know much about the history of Baltimore, you could kind of give a brief primer on some of the housing issues or some of the, you know, the racial barriers that have contributed to housing issues in this city.
Well, Baltimore City was actually the first city to have segregated housing as law. So that's something that even now a lot of people don't know. And so it was, you know, it was repealed not too long after it was enacted. But that sort of, if you, you know, think of it in terms of a line of dominoes, that sort of kicked off the domino, because anytime you make something law, people are going to give it a certain amount of credence. You know, even though they may not agree with the law, it's the law, so it must be important. And so even now in 2017, 50 some years later, we're living that legacy. We're still living that legacy. Redlining is still a thing, even though redlining and blockbusting were outlawed. Steering was outlawed. These are all still things. You know, people in certain neighborhoods don't get mortgages. People in certain neighborhoods, if you want to buy a house, you're not getting homeowners insurance. So if your house burns down, well, too bad. And, you know, so you have that sort of economic, you have that sort of redlining. And then you have speculators who go in and put up their We Buy Houses signs. Nothing says bad neighborhood like a neighborhood with a bunch of "we buy houses for cash" signs, you know, taped up to every phone pole, which, by the way, is illegal. So, you know, so that's today's version of blockbusting. Back in the day, it was, you know, the realtor would go to a white person's house that they wanted to buy the house cheap, and they would say, oh, well, you know, a black family is moving in across the street. And then suddenly, you know, Mr. White Guy and his wife, well, we need to sell, so we'll sell for cheap. And then, you know, the speculator would come and snap up all the properties.
And sell it for twice
what they
bought it for to the black families.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we still have that going on now. When we first moved to Baltimore in 2000, I had the services of two realtors. One was an older white lady. She was probably around my mom's age. And so there were houses that I would see ads for in the Baltimore Sun or the Baltimore City Paper. And, you know, because we were looking for a house to rent. And so I would find, you know, a description. And I didn't know a lot about Baltimore's neighborhoods. So I would tell her, oh, well, I want to see this house. And she would say, oh, no, you don't want to see that house. Or, you know, she would say, oh, you don't want to live in that neighborhood. And so I didn't quite understand what was going on at first. But after it happened a bunch of times, I worked with a guy who actually grew up here in Baltimore. And I said something to him and he was like, wow, that's illegal. That's called steering. And then I started looking into that. So I fired the older white lady. Then I hired this younger black woman because I thought, oh, she's young. You know, she'll get it. Like, she'll be a lot cooler. No, the first house. So I told her that we need to live in the city. The first house she took me to was out by the Walmart. That one way out in Catonsville.
Yeah, not the city.
No, so we were nowhere near the city. And B, if there's something about me that indicates that I would like to live in a house behind a Walmart, please do let me know so that I can change this about myself. So I fired her too. And then I would look in the paper and find houses that were for rent by people, not real estate companies. And you know, we eventually found one and everything was fine. But that happened to me in 2000. And you can only imagine what happens to black women who are trying to find housing and, you know, using the services of an unscrupulous realtor. Obviously, not all of them are like this, but apparently there's a few.
What is the most frustrating thing you come up against in your work?
I think probably the most frustrating is the lack of urgency. There's no real sense of urgency on the part of a lot of our government officials to really enact change, real change, not just let's come up with a plan that has no funding that will probably die by the time, you know, the next election rolls around. There's, you know, nobody's willing to go out on a limb and you know, I'm a big believer in that old saying, you know, go big or go home. So I find that there's not a lot of urgency. Like if you look at how many children in Baltimore are still being poisoned by lead paint, where's the urgency to stop this? It shouldn't be, oh, well, we hope to have lead levels in homes reduced by 2025. It should be no. If you are violating the law when it comes to lead paint, we're going to lock you up. And the time that I've lived in Baltimore, we've locked up one guy for not abating lead or reducing the risk of lead exposure in his properties. One guy. And in Toledo, Ohio, I just read the other day, they're locking up five. And that's just at one time. So, you know, there has to be a bigger sense of urgency. And I assure you that if the children who were being poisoned with lead were the children of wealthy white people, this problem would not have, it would not exist today. But there's just sort of this attitude of, well, it happens to poor black people, so let's build a new building in the Inner Harbor instead.
And like we were talking about race and housing intersecting, I mean, this is very much how public health and housing interact too. I mean, like, I feel like the more we talk, the more clear it becomes that housing just plays such a big part and such a role larger than shelter in the lives of everyone.
Housing is public health. That's the thing. You know, if you don't have a roof over your head, everything else in your life is guaranteed to fall apart in a really disastrous, horrific way. Housing is not an investment. Housing is not a get-rich-quick scheme. Housing is shelter. It's having a roof over your head. It's the place that you shouldn't... Housing is the one thing that people should not have to worry about. You should be able to worry about, you know, your children doing well in school. You should be able to worry about what you're going to cook for dinner tonight. You know, there's a million other things that we could worry about. Housing should never be one of them. Having a roof over your head should not be something that anybody has to ever worry about. And you should never have to worry about the condition of that housing. You should never, ever have to worry that your living room ceiling is going to collapse because your landlord hired some rando off the street to fix the roof, which of course that didn't work. And now water has been collecting and the ceiling falls in, and it falls in on one of your children. That actually happened. So not to me, but you know, that's an actual story that I was, you know, so nobody should have to worry that their health is going to go into decline, that they're going to go into financial ruin simply to put a roof over their head. That's just, to me, that's unthinkable.
Is there anything in your work that gives you hope?
The people who email me and call me, even though, you know, their stories a lot of times are horrific. I mean, these are people who are just like all of the rest of us. You know, they've got kids and they're busy and they work and, you know, their circumstances, while, you know, might be rather dire at the moment, you know, are no different than anybody else. And, you know, we have to start listening to people. I mean, I remember there was this one guy who lives in Charles Village. And this poor man has had all sorts of issues with the house next door to his, which was a slumlord-owned house. And so I have received emails from this guy about his house or a surrounding property or something going on right around his house for years. Super nice guy. Love him. Love his wife. So he gets a new city councilman. And so something happened. I think it had to do with a water pipe bursting. And so the guy is emailing everybody in the city, including me, you know, about this burst water pipe and whatnot. His city councilman hits reply all to one of the emails and says, somebody should do something about that. And I just thought, this is Baltimore. Like, this is Baltimore government, where you have a city councilman who says, somebody should do something about that. And so the guy who is emailing me about all of these different issues, it's people like him that keep me going, because he, you know, this guy's just trying to make a nice life for himself. Just like the lady the other day who emailed me about having, oh no, she called on the phone about having no heat. You know, she's just trying to take care of herself and her grandson. That's it. She doesn't want anything above and beyond just being able to live in a house with heat.
Well, Carol, I feel like we have a lot of questions, not a lot of answers. But thanks for coming in today. It was great speaking.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Carol Ott. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. If you like Female Trouble, it would help us out if you subscribed and left us a rating. We're also on Twitter at FML Trouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.